In the fabled land of Northern California, nestled in the Valley of Sacramento, two friends begin a journey to enlighten the world about their experience living life as a Xennial. But what is a Xennial, you may ask? If you wish to know, then follow them on their adventures.
Welcome to the Xennial Chronicles. This is James.
This is Mike.
And for this week's episode, still in our distance connections with each other, because that's going to be going on for a long time.
Yeah, it's going to be going on for quite some time, for sure.
Yeah, we're gonna have a discussion about a post that, you know, we've said before, right, Mike? We've said before that we try to keep as much political things out of the Xennial Chronicles as humanly possible.
For sure.
Again, that's why we took last week off, was because there was so much political strife going on that it would have been hard to have a conversation without touching on those in some way, shape, or form, especially for me, because I get a little hot-headed about some of these things. And then if I start, you'll start, and then it would just be
it's going to turn out like problems. A Wikipedia rabbit hole.
It's something similar to that, or like some of the various videos that people post online with, you know, long political rants into forever. And while we do think that politics are very important, I mean, I don't want to speak for you in this, but I am a firm believer that one of the most important, patriotic, and noble things that an American citizen can do is to go out and vote.
Absolutely.
Because voting is the only way that we're going to get anything to be changed, move forward as the common people of this planet. I mean, there is the idea of protesting for the things that you are for or against. There's the idea of, like back in the civil rights movement, sit-ins in restaurants and buses and whatnot. Those are other things that you can do. For the average everyday American who's just trying to still do the normal things in their life, voting is one of the simplest things that you can do. But part of voting is becoming educated about what you're voting for. In fact, every election year, which I mean, every 4 years, specifically with the presidential election, but no matter what, when there's an election coming up, when the packet of paperwork comes in, you know, you get the packet in the mail that has all the things that are being voted on, be they candidates for specific offices or measures or bills or whatever comes in, right?
Yeah.
When we get the packet here in our house, I take it upon myself as kind of the one in the house that's really most involved in political stuff, and one of the better one of the researchers of the house, because my wife does research on many other things. She knows that's the key to convincing me to anything, is just research the crap out of it and throw all the research at me,
right?
And when she's done that, it's like, because if she asks me about doing something, you know, buying something or trying out a new service or making some kind of change in our life, the first thing I ask her used to be, you know, what's the research on it? What have you looked at? What are the pros and cons of this? What are the, you know,
yeah.
I want to try to make as informed a decision as I possibly can. Some of the things I already know about. And so I automatically say, yeah, we'll do that. I've done research on it myself. Sometimes I haven't done the research and she's giving me the information. There's also times I've done the research, but she doesn't know that. I want to know if she's done the research too, because I want to see that we're both going into this decision with at least some logical thinking, some clear thinking, some, you know, and people are still going to act illogically to things because you still have emotions that drive you. But logic is a good basis to start from when you make your decisions. It shouldn't be the only thing you make your decisions by, but it should be the basis that you can start from.
Because
emotions override logic sometimes, where, you know, you have to sometimes go with the emotional response and recognize that you're going with the emotional response over the logical response, because you can't live with just the logical response.
Right.
I'm clarifying, because I don't want anybody to think that I'm just, you know, Spock in the whole thing and straight logic. No, I'm really at least early Spocking the whole thing. I'm more later Spocking the thing, where he recognizes the importance of the logic, but also understands the human side of himself and the humanity that's necessary and the feelings that are necessary as well.
Well, yeah, that's a combination of both of those things most of the time. It's very important to know and understand that.
Which is why, by the way, the in Star Trek, they made it very clear that Captain Kirk relied very heavily on listening to what Spock had to say and then listening to what McCoy had to say. Spock being the logical side of things, McCoy being the feelings, the emotions of things.
Yeah,
and absolutely. Used both of them to be able to temper what he was going to do.
Yep.
Which is it's a really good way to portray how decision making should happen within ourselves. We need to access both sides and come to the best conclusion for both sides.
Yeah.
The one you can live with the most.
Yep.
So when, like I say, when we get those political packets in, I start doing the research and I sit the other adults down in the house at a certain point, and I'm like, I try to, as much as possible, with as much of an unbiased, because no matter what, no matter how unbiased we try to be, we still have our own personal bias. So right. It's always a struggle. But I try to be as unbiased as possible and go over the various things and say, okay, so if you say yes to this measure, this is what the measure says is going to happen. If you say no, this, you know, this won't happen. Now, you know, yes, this measure say it's going to have add an extra tax to, I don't know, a few years ago we had one in California where it's an extra so many cents to, for each gallon of gas, and it's going to be, it's supposed to be set up to go towards you know, road construction and road upkeep and whatnot.
Yeah.
However, historically, those monies haven't always gone to those purposes.
Right.
They've been taken and used for other purposes. So we discuss what the history has been of these of similar type of things. And, you know, I do that level of research so that if the other adults in the house want to have questions, want to ask, you know, do, you know, will this really work? Is this really going to happen this way? Well, it's supposed to, but it doesn't always happen that way. However, you know, we try to weigh as many pros and cons with it as possible and then have the person who's actually doing the voting make their own decision on what they feel is the right thing to vote with.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, information is important.
Yes.
Now, you know what? For one of the few times ever, I lost where I was going with this.
I was curious if you were going to segue into something else or not. Normally, I'm the one like that does that, James.
I know. I'm channeling a little bit of you right now. Maybe I should go back to college for a little while and take myself an acting class, maybe an improv class. That might get me more in the vein. Improv classes can help with stuff like this. Maybe I should take another one. It's been a while. Anyway, so you can see how even just this little bit of political conversation gets my brain going in that direction, because it's a heavy thing for me.
Yeah.
And so the original point I was at way back at the beginning was that on our Facebook page, I had posted a meme that was kind of comparing some of the protests and situations that were happening over the last 2-3 weeks to a very popular movie from the late 90s. Popular in the sense that it kind of, it was a very big budget movie. It was an adaptation of a book. Which, you know, many, many books are adapted at different points in time. So it was a fairly modern book that was adapted pretty quickly after it was written.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a kind of, it's a cultural milestone movie for a lot of people. It helped to, I think, catapult one of the actors' careers. It helped to add more color and flavor to another actor's career.
Right.
It gave us a lot of fun catchphrases. And it helped a director move on even further in his career.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the movie Fight Club. And yes, I know, we're not supposed to talk about Fight Club. But today we are, because I had originally sent that meme to you, right?
Yes.
Or did you send it to me? Which one?
I sent it to you.
You sent it to me. Okay.
And
you
it
sent
was, it to me. I saw it and I was like, oh my goodness. This image be? Yeah.
I loved the meme, but at the same, I was a little conflicted at the time. Well, slightly conflicted, but I was in my kind of inflamed moment. So I was like, I think we should post this on the Xenial Chronicles Facebook page.
Yeah.
And again, normally we don't try to post any of the two things that get too political. I save that for my own personal Facebook page.
Right.
And anybody that is on my personal Facebook page knows I just flood my page with anything political.
Right.
That's just kind of, that's what I use that for. I don't put pictures of my kids up because I don't necessarily like having pictures of my kids on the internet. I know that people can find them if they want to outside of what I put up.
Yeah.
But I try not to put too many pictures of my kids up. And my family life and personal life is something I talk about in person. I don't necessarily blast that all over social media.
Of course.
Like, again, that's kind of my personal stuff.
Yeah.
I'm old, so it's not that I'm old. I'm in that age range where things about myself I don't mind sharing, but I don't think it's appropriate for me to share a bunch of stuff about my kids. If they want to do that at some point, they can do it themselves. They don't need it from me.
Right. You know,
I will occasionally, but I keep it most to myself. Right.
Yeah.
So, but when this meme came up, and we discussed it, we said, yeah, okay, we'll put it on the page. You had, mentioned that you kind of had a not so pleasurable, experience watching this movie. You were not very fond of it.
That's very true. I was never fond of it, even the first time I watched it. It was something that I saw that a group of friends of mine that were really into. But every time I watched it, every time I saw it, because I've seen it more than once, and it's one of the most heralded movies in cinema currently.
It is.
And it's got a lot of cool tricks, and it's got like all this kind of stuff. Like personally, my opinion of it, though, is that it takes... Okay, now, I am saying this as someone who has not read the book. I'm going to be completely flat-out honest. I am not familiar with Chuck Palahniuk's writing. I'm not familiar with the direct story. I did read a plot synopsis on it, and it seems that the film, for the most part, got most of the information. However, there's quite a bit of convolution that happens and gets lost in the over-dramatization of certain things. The book does work in an extreme fashion. There's some extreme stuff that goes down.
Yeah, the book is far more extreme than what the movie is.
Yeah, I have read the book. Okay, you've read the book. Okay, so you're coming at this from an entirely different angle than I am. Because here's the deal. I am coming at it from an angle that maybe about 95% of the people that are familiar with this movie come from. Which is, watch the movie, never read the book, and similar to other films that I feel are a bit of a ham-handed way of introducing idealism that should be discussed in a civil manner and should actually be included in some form of developmental discourse between people. It is unfortunately, it's unfortunately like over just
praised, maybe?
Yes, well overpraised. That's okay. I was looking for the right word, but it is well overpraised, far beyond the point with, I'm going to hold back on my initial, idea of as we continue, unless I should.
I think no. Here's the thing. I first of all, I'm approaching this just about the movie because it was years after watching the movie that I had read the book, and I've only read the book one time.
Okay,
it really wasn't that interesting, to be honest.
Okay.
The writer has even said that his book and the movie, while the movie is based on the book, they are two completely separate things, and he's perfectly okay with that.
Okay.
They are completely separate entities, and we're just dealing with the movie of this at this point. Because you're right, the majority of people only really know about the movie. There are probably some people who have seen the movie who would be shocked that there was even a book written about it, and they would think maybe it was an adaptation afterwards.
Yeah.
No, the book came first, the movie came after.
Yep.
But they are two completely separate beasts. The author has recognized they're separate beasts. David Fincher, the director of Fight Club, has recognized that they're separate beasts.
Yes. Okay.
So they're not. I'm not going to speak today about the connection between the two of them because that's unimportant to the point that I'm making. The film is actually the thing that I'm wanting to comment on.
Yes.
And what I'm commenting on it is I agree with you, kind of. I agree with you that there is a lot more love for this movie than there should be, but for the wrong reason.
Yes.
People love this movie for the wrong reason. They don't love it for the right reason. And part of the issue with that comes into something that you and I actually discussed about, you, me, and your wife specifically just had big discussions about another movie last year that came out that we even did some discussion on the podcast about this movie. It was a big cultural milestone movie. Was seen is actually very comparable to this in the way it was seen and some of the themes that it dealt with. I'm speaking of the Joker movie.
And
there's some similarity and some themes in this between these two movies. You wouldn't think so, but there actually are. And one of the parts of the conversation that I know that we had, whether it was on the podcast or whether it was our personal conversation, had to do with the intent of the director when the director made the movie.
Okay.
And the fact that there's audience interpretation of the movie, and then there's intent of the director when the director made the movie.
Right. Okay.
Example, a really good example. Recently, the one of the directors of the Matrix trilogy. I don't remember which one of the Wachowskis it was that came out and said something about it.
Yeah.
But came out and said that they realized later, because of all the developments they were going through in their life at the time, that the Matrix trilogy was really an allegory for trans people and trans people having to find their place in the world and in the universe. And if you think back and think about the Matrix movies, that makes a lot of sense. In fact, one of the characters in the first movie, the character of Switch, I believe, wore white when inside the Matrix, was supposed to be one gender inside the Matrix and one gender outside the Matrix.
Whoa, okay.
As a representation of what was already happening, because at that time the Wachowskis identified as male,
right,
and have since both brothers at the time have since gone through various personal changes and now identify as female.
Right.
And that was part of part of that journey was happening within their minds, was happening as part of their discovery of themselves during the time that they made the Matrix movies. And so the realization later came that the things that were going on in their head, the understanding, trying to understand their place in the world, was part of what helped them write and was the inspiration behind the writing of the Matrix movies and the production of the Matrix movies, direction of those movies.
Okay.
So again, the intent of the filmmaker is an important point to look at when you're looking at the film. And then also, again, the response of the audience and how the audience sees the movie. And the thing about the intent of the filmmaker, David Fincher's intent when making this movie, was not the intent that ended up being the love that the audience has for the film. He had a completely different intent than what it gets its popularity from.
Okay.
And that's part of the key of maybe as I explain this and explain what this movie was really trying to do, not what people thought it was trying to do, but it was what it was actually trying to do.
Okay.
Maybe that gives you a different view of the movie. Maybe it helps you reconcile some of your feelings. Maybe it doesn't. But that's what we're here today to do and talk about.
Okay.
Is what David Fincher was really trying to do with this film and how the audience didn't see it. And what's funny is that also may have been his intent.
His intent was that it would be misinterpreted properly. Interesting.
Yes.
Okay. All right. This may develop a new respect for that after all this is over. I'm not quite sure yet.
Yeah. And it's convoluted.
So should we open this up as like, maybe I should somewhat synopsize my idea of what the film became?
Yes, please. Actually, that's a good idea. However, I do want to say something real quick.
Yes.
If you've gotten this far into the podcast, first off, if you have not seen Fight Club before,
yes,
stop the podcast, go watch Fight Club, finish the podcast.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. At this point, it's best to watch Fight Club before you know. Yes. Okay, so we're going to be talking about spoilers. I may or may not mention a couple in the middle of my rants. It might also be a good idea to get familiar with a couple of the other films that I may be talking about. I'm going to be referencing some other stuff, so I'm going to fair warn on this one. I'm going to reference V for Vendetta. I'm going to reference the Joker film. Now that you bring it up, that makes a lot of sense. Not entirely by giving away a huge amount of it, but mainly talking about its influences and its impact on its audience. And obviously Fight Club as well. So yes, do what James said. Watch Fight Club. If it helps, watch V for Vendetta. Watch.
I have a confession to make.
Yes.
I have actually never seen V for Vendetta.
Okay, I have. And I have also seen Joker. I don't believe you've seen Joker yet, right?
We'll probably never see it, but I know enough about the movie to know.
Totally cool. I'm not judging. I'm not judging any of that. No. You know what? You know how to research something. So,
we've had the Joker conversation a few times. So.
Yeah, for sure. And I've gone back and forth with you on it as well, and I fully understand that. Okay, so let's see here. I was going to talk about another one that I want to. By the way, for anybody that wants to, for the sake of the difference in interpretation that I will be talking about, I will also be referencing the film 1984, which I have read the book and I have watched the film. And now it could be my experience with reading the book first and then watching the film after that gave me an entirely different viewpoint, but films like 1984 is one that I will be referencing. I will be referencing A Clockwork Orange just for the sake of asking those types of questions. All of these books, all of these films that we're talking about are essentially the main storyline, as far as I interpret them to be, are to question the rigidity and the role of the person in the society that surrounds them, and also what is the balance of good and evil? What is in Fight Club? What is the balance for me of what does it mean to be materialistic? Those types of things. But I'm going to just go right into it here. So the issue with we're going to start here. Okay, starting with Fight Club. So, again, I have never read the book. From what I've seen of the film, the essential idea is that from what I can interpret from it, it's about the idea of letting go of your materialistic nature and realizing that society in itself is a construct that is just essentially made up of routines and things like money and basically things like money and social construct and all these things don't really matter in the grand scheme of things. And what should be concentrated on is the idea that you as an individual have the capability of your own self-control. It's almost like this really fucked up Zen Buddhist kind of thing.
More like an Ayn Rand kind of situation.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I get you there. Okay. So, the issue that I take with it is it's not even so much the method that's used as far as the basic underlying story. The problem comes down to the convoluted way that idealism is expressed, and it's been a while, so I forget the exact ending. And I know that I believe that the ending of the book is different from the film. But
there are some points, yeah.
Okay. So,
but again, don't worry about comparing the book to the film.
Right.
It's
more about the idea of what the film is supposed to put out, right?
Well, and what the film has come to represent, what the film has come to be as its own life. It's
right.
The film is a cultural milestone. The book is not. It's not like something like 1984,
right,
where the book was a cultural milestone and then they made a film on it.
Yeah.
Or again, I just referenced Atlas Shrugged in a way.
Yeah.
That or even Fountainhead, if we're going to go full Ayn Rand. Mm-hmm. But those things were cultural milestones as the novels, and then
yes,
movies were made about them, or other things were made. The thing is, the book Fight Club is not a cultural milestone. Again, most people don't even know that there was a book written beforehand. The film is the cultural milestone. The film is what people look at for the situation. And that's, you don't have to worry about comparing the what happens in the book as opposed to what happens in the film. Again, they are their own two separate products, and the film is what has influenced people. The film is what is the focus of the situation.
So there's a couple of things that I forget from certain parts and pieces of the film. I'm sure you've seen it more often than I have, but essentially, from what I can remember, is Ed Norton is pretty much in a dead-end job. It looks like some kind of an office job of sorts. It's very office spacey at the beginning with a lot more muted colors. And he's kind of lost his place, right, in society. He's depressed. Yeah. He is dissatisfied with his place in life. He doesn't feel like he lives for himself. And this is something that so many people can connect to. A lot of people can connect to this. So essentially he meets somebody, and I can't remember how they meet, but essentially he meets someone, the character Tyler Durden, which, by the way, Edward Norton's character is never named, if I remember correctly. So, and it's
he is just called the narrator.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say the narrator is never named either.
The narrator.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, the narrator in the book is never named either, but he's called the narrator in the film as well. That's cool. But anyways, he doesn't quote-unquote have a name that he's referred to. But he essentially he meets this guy named Tyler Durden. And Tyler Durden basically is some, you know, philosophical cat who starts to teach him about the ideas of social construct and how they don't really matter in the grand scheme of things. And he does this by essentially starting a fist fight with him out of nowhere. And this guy, essentially, these two guys start collecting, a small troop of people that start a club that is essentially exactly what it is. It's an underground fight club where they fight in, I think they fight in the parking garage most of the time, of the car lot of the building that they work at.
It starts in the basement of a bar.
The basement of a bar. Okay. This and, like I said, I'm very far removed from the film, but essentially the idea is that it's more about trying to take control of your life in this weird, convoluted way of doing it, which is essentially just dudes kick the shit out of each other, and it's like some honor system of sorts. And it really, like, it loses me in that, but it comes down to it touches on a lot of these points where people can easily it almost comes down to where people can easily attach themselves to the idea that their position in life is very similar to the narrator's.
Cultism.
What is it?
Cultism.
Yes.
It's the same way that cults bring in people. They do a similar thing. I'll get into that further as go through my explanation.
Okay. But the problem that I have with it, and this is where it falls apart. Most of the people that I know of, the audience that attaches itself to this film, are people that are in positions where they are benefiting from all of these things that the narrator does not benefit from, even though this is more about like social awareness, wokeness, whatever the fuck you want to call it on my end, okay? I'll be real. But the idea here is it's almost like it's appealing to the wrong audience, but at the same time, it's appealing to the primal urge for violence without actually providing a real answer to the philosophy. The answer to how do you find your place in life is burn the whole fucking thing down. And I don't understand it. I don't like it because it doesn't provide a true answer. And that's where it just gets lost in the middle of this bullshit, even though, dude, they fucking kill a guy. There's a bunch of people that are hooked on drugs. There's the love interest is, I don't even fucking know what she is. And it's just everybody is a lost, like, they're a bunch of lost cogs knocking against each other in a machine that continues to work for some reason until they decide to destroy it. And then there's no consequence for it. There's no aftermath. There's no, like, it's almost like the purpose that they find is to just stop giving a fuck, and then the world continues to go on anyway. But I don't understand if that is the point of the film. However, what really gets me is that because it shows no true consequence and it doesn't show aftermath for the actions of essentially what you're seeing is fucking domestic terrorism in some degree. This guy fucking blows up a building, doesn't he? And dies while doing it or some shit too?
No, he doesn't die. And multiple buildings are blown up. And it's actually kind of important what buildings are being blown up.
Okay.
They are actually very, very significant buildings that are being blown up.
Okay. So the idea here is...
there's actually a significance to where the, even though it's never discussed technically where that is set.
Right.
There's actually something very technically specific about where it's set.
Oh, okay. I did not know that, but I will. I'm going to be glad to hear about a lot of this. Now, here's the biggest problem that I have with the marketing of the film, and I may just be stating that I straight up don't understand it because I don't, and I may be missing a lot of vital points here. Obviously, so, and that's fine. But the problem that I got from the feel from the multiple times that I've watched the film, where I get lost in the, sensationalism of it, and I lose major parts and pieces of the story because there's all these little cool little Easter eggs and bullshit that's going on in the middle of the film. And don't get me wrong, Fincher is a fucking fantastic director, but he really knows how to play with your eyes, and he knows how to play with your senses very well. I just feel like it's so overdone that you get lost in the point of the film. Like, the point of the film it stops making sense about halfway through. And then what ends up happening is it also, it's almost like, I think I told this to you and I'm going to say it here. It's like Bob Marley's music in film form made for angry white guys.
Yes, actually, yes, yes.
And that's
very much yes.
Okay. That's where I get it. Like
very much yes.
Every bro white dude that I've ever heard of that's, and I've always not really dug this. And I'm not saying there's anything bad about Marley's music. I think Marley's music is absolutely fantastic. Reggae is amazing, and Bob Marley was an incredible, talented person. But a lot of people don't realize that he wasn't about smoking weed and peace and love. That guy was a militant revolutionist. And I mean, like, I'm talking, he was calling for some Che Guevara-level shit. Like, he really wanted to burn the whole fucking thing down. But a lot of these guys...
He's not a sit around in a group and smoke it down and have some fun.
I mean, he was like,
seriously.
Yeah.
Seriously, Snoop Dogg, who most people would associate with being way more violent than Bob Marley, he's the dude that just wants to sit in a room and smoke it out with everybody.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly it. Like, he would sit in a room and smoke and cook fucking bread with Martha Stewart and shit, like, because he does, and he's awesome, and I love him. But
I don't see Bob Marley hanging out with Martha Stewart. That just would never have happened.
Right, for sure.
Maybe, like, as Marley got older, he might have calmed down a little bit. But no, you're right. Marley's misinterpreted. You have all these college kids who get their first high school kids and then college kids. You get their first real taste of smoking weed. They want that peace and love. They're listening to the reggae. They're kicking around the hacky sack. They're wearing the multicolored crocheted woven hats.
Yeah,
you know, they're the white guys getting dreads.
Yeah, completely missing the fucking point, like, and not realizing that Bob Marley is talking about, like, seriously, like, how long will they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Like, how do people not understand that he's saying you need to get the fuck up and kick the shit out of your oppressors, or else you will never be free. You will never win. You will always be a slave to whatever the system is that's in place. And that, the thing is that Marley spoke as a prophet from a position of true oppression. One of the closest, from the standpoint of a misinterpreted prophet, I consider him to be one of the closest celebrity entities to Jesus that we have seen in a very long time.
Okay, that's a hell of a comment.
I say that because it has to do with he was a revolutionary prophet, and I know that. It's like listening to Rage Against the Machine and not realizing that they're communist.
Well, I mean, they're not communist, they're socialist. But there's a difference.
I thought that they were. I thought that they were an off. Well, do you mean communist as in like
communism? Communism is a specific type of political platform. Socialism is an economic platform. They are socialists. They're not really communist.
Okay. So okay. Good. Thank you.
They're more about the social part of the movement, not the economic part of the. They're more about the economic and social part of the movement. They are not necessarily about the. They are political, but not political in the sense of being actual communists. Real quick note on communism, it's basically the same as what you deal with in a capitalist republic, which we are a capitalist republic.
Right.
The top 5% have all the money and control all the industry. In the capitalist republic, that top 5% is all of the business people. In a communist society, that top 5% is the government and the military. That's the real difference between the two.
Gotcha.
But that's a discussion.
Right. And I don't want to get too deep into that.
We want to have a full. And by the way, if there is ever a celebrity that is closest to Jesus, it is Keanu Reeves. Fight me on that. Jesus was never about war. He was about peace and love. And if there's anybody that is about peace and love and helping your fellow person, mm-hmm. that is a celebrity in this modern world, it's freaking Keanu Reeves.
Fully understood. I'm just saying. Fully understood. He's, the reason why I said what I did was because deal. The reason why I said what I did about Marley is the reason why I said what I did about Marley is because he embodied the idea of realizing that you are the oppressed, the realization that you are the oppressed and that the oppressors will continue to take advantage of you unless you stop them from doing it. And I'm sorry, okay. Even Jesus went apeshit when he found that his house was getting abused by those oppressors.
What are you talking about? When he found moneylenders in the church?
Moneylenders in the church, yeah. Moneylenders in the church, hell, turn the other cheek, man. That thing was you can't break me kind of a moment. That was a revolutionary moment.
Again, discussion for a whole nother time.
Right. I know we're getting weird deep into it, but basically the idea is that for summarizing this, not having to go too far out, the idea of Fight Club to me, I feel like it's shopped to the wrong market. It's like I said, it's similar to Marley's music being appropriated for an entirely different type of person than who it was intended for, or at least the point is being appropriated to something else. It's being completely misinterpreted, and it's almost like to sell to an oppressor, to sell to the culture, to sell to a cult, selling to a culture that is responsible for the boy, I'm getting real political here, and I apologize for it, but selling to a culture that builds its power on an oppressive nature by telling that culture it is the oppressed culture, I just feel like it's not only wrong, but it's dangerous.
Well, and I can understand that argument completely. That's one of the arguments, or that's a similar argument. I would say one of them, but it's a similar argument that I made towards the Joker film as an example.
I can understand.
Here's
that.
Here's the thing. Here's where I totally understand everything that you're saying about the movie, about Fight Club, all your feelings about Fight Club. Mm-hmm. I totally understand it. Totally get it. And you are so right, but also so wrong. And it's beautiful you're both.
Cool.
There is a reason for this dichotomy. You are seeing the top level of it. You are. You're seeing the exact top level that David Fincher wanted you to see.
Okay.
But you're not seeing the actual subtext that was the true point of the film. And what we're gonna do right now is we're gonna take a break.
Oh,
and
cool.
When we come back,
we're gonna expand on that.
I'm going to tell you what the subtext is and why he did advertise it exactly as you said he did. He did advertise for that exact group looking the exact way it did, but he had a deeper purpose and meaning. In fact, I'll give you something to think about over the break. I know our breaks are not necessarily very long for us; they're a little longer than they are for you.
Chew on this for the next 30 seconds.
You remember the movie? You remember the movie Wayne's World?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
You remember when they have Bill Murray's brother? People don't know that it's Bill Murray's brother, but it's still Bill Murray's brother, who's the owner of the arcade, the Noah's Arcades.
Yes.
They have him on the Wayne's World show.
Yes.
And the whole a sphincter says what?
Yeah.
A sphincter says what? See, this is that conversation is basically a really dumbed down version of what David Fincher was trying to do. And we'll get back to that.
Does that mean that David Fincher just called me a sphincter?
Yeah, kind of. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey friends, this is Mike from the Xennial Chronicles reminding you to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Zenchron, spelled X-E-N-C-H-R-O-N, to keep up to date on all things TXC. And please check out our official website, thezennialchronicles.com, or if that's too much to type, zenchron.com. Thanks again for listening, and now, back to the show.
And we're back, everybody.
What's going on?
So like I said before the break, you're right in what you were feeling about this movie. You're right in many of your interpretations, because again, this was what David Fincher was trying to portray on the surface for this movie.
Okay.
He wanted you to see those things.
And was the intention to be so glorified or so negative?
Well,
was it supposed to be one way or the other? Was that the purpose? Was it supposed to be multi-leveled for different audiences at the same time?
Well, here's the thing about it. Here's the funny thing about it is it's supposed to be, in a sense, you think it's glorified, and it may come off like that on the surface, but in many ways it's not glorified. In fact, it is almost the opposite of glorified.
Yeah, I can understand, and because it is ugly. It's a very ugly film.
That's the thing is here's where we,
and I can understand that being intentional, but I'm curious as far as the presentation, the placement, the when and the where kind of a thing.
Yeah. Here's where we'll start.
Okay.
First thing I want to ask you, who is the protagonist of the film? Who is the main character of the film?
Well, the main character would be the narrator, as far as I know.
The narrator is the main character of the film.
Okay. Well, it does take place from his point of view, and he's in practically every scene of the film. Yeah.
Who is the villain of the film?
It's shopped around to be the character of Tyler Durden. And obviously, since I've seen it multiple times, we both have, I know and understand the plot twist. Should we just get into major spoiler territory at one point?
Well, the plot twist, of course, being that, yeah, we'll get into it at this point. The plot twist being that Tyler Durden is not a real person.
Right.
He is basically an aspect of the narrator.
Right.
He's represented of his kind of his id, maybe.
It seems like,
or because super, actually superego. But
yes.
Anyway.
Yeah. You had a point, and I was gonna try to, because you do see levels and pieces, like if you watch it more than once, you'll notice that the character becomes like the influence of the Tyler Durden character starts to show up before he becomes fully personified in the film. And then the remnants still continue, but please continue.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm interrupting.
First to start off, the job that the narrator has, he's in insurance.
Yes.
He deals with insurance, or not insurance, quality control for vehicles, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's a pretty boring job. It's most of the time in office, and then a lot of time spent traveling from place to place to check out cars that have had issues and whatnot, whether they need to be recalled or whether they don't need to be recalled.
Okay.
His job has made it so that he has a kind of skewed view of human life, and in fact, the idea that his company has taught him to put a dollar value on human life.
Okay.
Okay.
Understood. I can see that.
So if it costs more to recall all the vehicles than it costs to pay out the settlements to the families of the people that are killed, they won't recall. They'll just let the people be killed and pay out the settlements because it's cheaper that way. he's seen what he's saying is that life has been by the way these companies and corporations work, by the way the modern society works, life has been, and the funny thing is this isn't a modern thing. This is something that's been going on for all of civilization.
Yeah.
Anybody that's not part of the group of elites is basically you have a dollar value on your life as far as the elites are concerned.
Yeah.
The whoever is the top echelon of whatever society you're in, you have a dollar amount associated with your life.
Right.
And it's just that simple, that easy. But he's becoming aware of this at this point in his life, and he's roughly in his early to mid 30s. He's coming to realize that he's consumed all of these things, and yet he lives in an apartment alone. He has all these things that are supposed to have brought him happiness. They're supposed to have brought him fulfillment in life. And none of them have really brought him anything.
Okay.
He's just kind of operating through life. He encounters this character of Tyler Durden. And as they become more intermeshed in their connections, and again, this is a character that does not physically exist. He's the only person who sees this guy.
Mm-hmm.
This is a manifestation of his own mind. This is basically the wild side of himself, what he thinks is the reckless, carefree side of himself that he never indulged in at any point in his life.
Okay.
This is, he also feels, and it's discussed very often, think of the things, I know it's been a while since you've seen it, but when he's talking about the various things in his apartment that he's bought, he talks about the furniture that he's bought, the dishes that he's bought. If you look in his, when you get the very short view in his apartment before he blows up his apartment, which he blows up his apartment.
Right.
At first he thinks it's Tyler that blew up his apartment, but since Tyler is him, he blew up his own apartment.
Right, he blew up his own apartment.
All of the things that he had, the furniture, the dishes, what are those more connected to? Male or female? In society. Think about it. If men are talking about the things that they have, they talk about, like in yours and my instance, we may talk about all the musical instruments that we own. Some men will talk about the cars that they have, or the guns that they have, or the toys, like, not the toys that I have, because I have actual toys, because I'm a child at heart.
Right.
But I'm talking more like, ATVs and sea-doo watercraft.
For sure.
And boats and those type of things. Those are considered masculine things to have bought.
Right.
Couches and dishes. Those are feminine things to have bought. This is a man who is going through this existential crisis of, where's my place in this new world as a man? As a man in this world. I don't have a job where I'm working labor. I'm a skinny kind of guy. I have nothing that gets out any of my masculinity. All of my masculinity is gone. I don't have a girlfriend. I live in this apartment that I'm more worried about buying all of these things for my house, to make my house more pleasing. Where's my masculinity gone? And you have Tyler Durden show up, being kind of the epitome of this carefree masculinity, do whatever. And he's been trying to, the narrator's been trying to combat these issues of depression and trying to find his place in the world by attending various meetings. Specifically, he finds himself attending meetings for people that are cancer survivors or people with cancers of different type, different illnesses. Different things that are happening to them.
Yeah.
Because he attends these meetings because when he sees the level of despair that these people have, it makes him feel less despair about his life. He can rationalize, these people are worse off than me. These people have it so much better than I do. And he can feel just a little bit better about himself. It's in this place, in these places, that he meets some of the other characters in the movie. He meets Meatloaf's character, Robert Paulson, who is suffering from having taken improper medications, and he grew large breasts as a result.
Right.
Which are a funny plot point, but think about what that entails.
Right.
This is a man who was a boxer or a fighter of some type, took steroids and various other things to try to make him better at what he was doing, and he ended up growing huge breasts
that
he could never really get rid of.
Right.
What has that done to the character? That has emasculated him.
Right. I understand.
Taking away his manliness.
I'm kind of getting that vibe from it. Okay. I kind of felt like I was seeing that vibe. It's jogging my memory on but that's kind of one of the things that I was talking about essentially, right?
Well, what you're seeing is the appeal to these men who are in this modern society, feeling that the modern society is emasculating them. It's not letting them be men anymore. They can't, you know, do the manly things. They have to be able to be sensitive and care about their house and do dishes and not have women do all those jobs and actually take care of their children instead of just, you know, take them outside and throw a ball with them. That's as far as they should have to go with taking care of their children.
I know that this isn't your only point, but that sounds pretty fucking pouty to me.
No, that's.
And is that the point? Is that the purpose?
No, this is one of many, because this is one of the things that during that time period, during the late 90s, you had people from the boomer generation and the Gen X generation that were getting into, especially the Gen X generation, they were getting into parenthood at that point, right?
Oh, yeah.
The Gen
X were having their kids at this point. Yeah.
And this is definitely targeted towards the male Gen X audience in this mindset of they didn't get to be the manly men that their fathers were, which they hated, by the way.
Right.
I mean, how many songs do we have, Cats in the Cradle, about, you know, the father not connecting with his kid properly, and you never get the chance to connect with him before he dies. Right. They're being I don't know, asked, I guess, by society to be more sensitive, more understanding, more human than what the previous generation's men were supposed to be, more emotionally connected.
Right.
And they're feeling like their manliness is being taken away from them. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to find something to blame it on, because it can't be about them. It can't be about accepting themselves. It can't be about something that's their fault. They have to try to find something to blame it on. It's this consumerist society. They want us to do all these things, buy all these things. And they're emasculating us so that we buy all these things and we take part in all of this stuff. You know, they're taking away our individuality as men. And it's very much, you have a guy who's got a good job, good enough to afford an apartment in a fairly nice city, all on his own, which is impossible nowadays, but even then, it was a nice apartment in a nice place.
Yeah.
He had a pretty good job.
Yeah.
He's got a good job. He's not financially disadvantaged. He's not coming from some poor home where he's got to be on, you know, some kind of welfare or county aid to make it by, barely make his rent, living in a slum. None of those things are happening. It's a nice apartment.
No, he's in a decent place. Yeah, that's the thing. Okay, so, and also another thing, just a side point from what you had mentioned earlier, I mean, trying to equate your worth or your position in life and whether or not you've got it bad or whether or not you're happy or not by comparing it to other people that have it worse off than you, that's toxic as shit to do.
Yes.
So what you're telling me is the guy's battling with his role as a man in an evolving society, and at the same time trying to convince himself the wrong way that he doesn't have it as bad as he thinks he does. Right?
Well, it's not so much that he doesn't care about convincing himself. He just cares about trying to feel better at this point.
That's the thing is it's completely backwards, because he's trying to make himself feel better by feeling sorry for other people.
Yep.
And you're not supposed to fucking do that.
But the thing is, that's the only way he knows how to do it.
Understood. This is like, he's lost. He's completely lost. I understand that part of the character. I'm not entirely disconnected from that concept. I am not.
There are many people that have gone through that.
Right.
And his connection with humanity is gone because of his job. Because his job teaches him to see people as a commodity, to see people as a dollar sign.
Right.
When he ends up having trouble going back to these meetings, when he meets a girl at one of these meetings who's doing a somewhat similar thing, but I think for different reasons. I think that her life is actually awful, the character of Marla. Her life is actually kind of awful. She lives in a pretty bad situation. She has to steal food to be able to feed herself. Right. In fact, there's a one of those Meals on Wheels comes by at one point in the movie, and she takes food off of the Meals on Wheels because she really doesn't have the money to take care of herself regularly.
Right.
She attends the meetings for a similar thing. However, she's a little bit more understanding of the situation she's in than what he understands his own situation. She knows that her life is crap.
Well, it's kind of on its face. It's like that, obviously, directly in front of her, and it's obvious to everyone else, right?
Well, and that makes it hard for him to go to the meetings, because if her life is crap and she's going there to feel better by seeing their lives as crap, what is he getting from it anymore? He can't feel better about it anymore. This is when Tyler becomes more involved in his life. They have the fist fight that you're referring to.
Yes.
And they start this fight club. This idea, first, just the fight club of people fighting each other, and the raw masculinity that's involved in these fights is amazing, really. The like you say, it's that violence that you're seeing. It's intended that way. It's intended to be as visceral as humanly possible.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the point disgusting. It's supposed to be ugly. It's destructive.
They're getting out their manliness. They're exerting themselves as men. They're not chained anymore and emasculated anymore. They have their balls back. They're able to do this manly thing of fighting each other.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get the point of where you're coming from, and it's starting to kind of allow... It's starting to allow room for some level of respect, because the first thing that I saw in any of that is just like, these assholes are literally just destroying themselves and calling themselves men for it. Like, yes, that's all they're doing. I can understand that being the point, if that's the case.
And in fact, Tyler even goes on the rant about how their fathers were told to do one thing and now they're told to do another thing, and they don't know where they don't know how to be men anymore because their fathers didn't teach them how to be men properly anymore.
Right.
He says outright that one of the many themes of this, in fact, it's probably one of the more central themes, if not the most central theme, is this idea that these men of this era feel emasculated.
Right.
And the part of the problem was they hadn't necessarily been taught the tools of how to reconcile that emasculation in their life with it being an okay thing. They've never been shown that it's okay to be that way, that there are ways to still be a man if you want to be without doing these historically toxic masculine things. This is maybe one of the first movies that really takes on this idea of toxic masculinity being a bad thing. So bad a thing, by the way, that the only way that the narrator is able to reconcile these things happening in him is he has to create a hallucination that is a completely different character in his life.
Right.
To represent that toxic masculinity wanting to come out, because he knows how toxic it is. It can't be a part of him. It has to be completely separate from him. And he's trying to work himself through the idea of finding the balance between the feelings of emasculation that he feels and this toxic masculinity that is also there that he feels is trying to pull him and draw him in.
Okay.
And it draws all these other people in.
And that's what it is. It's how catchy the concept of the – it's essentially – it's also a film about how catchy the concept of that violent tendency can spread to other people. And
the violent tendencies, the cult mentality, the toxic masculinity. You have one person engaging in it and another person, and these other men feel empowered by the ability to express this – deep-seated rage that they feel, that because some outside agency is stopping them from being the true men that they really need to be. This is relevant in some of the things that are going on in our society today. And it's funny, the reason why I wanted to post this picture on our Facebook was because if you look at, when you go back and watch Fight Club again, how many people of color do you see that are a part of the Fight Club?
This Not is that I remember that any deals, of them. I don't remember no, any of them, do I? I don't think there are any.
This is a movie that deals with there's very few, if any. This is a movie that specifically deals with the concept of white males in their 30s trying to deal with what they feel is the loss of their ability to be masculine men and having to basically being called on toxic masculinity and how bad it is.
Has Fincher like called this out himself and said this is what it's about? Like, has he had to explain that? Or is this something that can be gleaned from the film itself?
Yes and yes.
Wow. Okay.
Let me continue on.
That's interesting because it does come off like a pro toxic masculinity propaganda film, whereas it is not. It's actually anti.
He has specifically said this is a satire trying to point out how toxic these thoughts and ideas are. I mean, toxic enough that Tyler gives the narrator a burn on his hand using toxic chemicals to brand him as part of this new toxic thing.
Yep.
They take the one guy that is probably the best looking guy of the group, interestingly enough, somebody who eventually gets to play the Joker, and in fact say that as the narrator is beating his face completely irrecognizable, just beating him all to hell, he is saying he just felt like he needed to destroy something beautiful. This is a character that's probably the most androgynous looking, and in fact has played trans characters in movies. We're talking Jared Leto here.
Yeah. I remember.
He beats his face to a complete unrecognizable pulp. And for the rest of the movie, you can barely recognize him under makeup because his face is so badly beaten from that fight. And he's probably the one man that most represents a feminine side of things.
Mm-hmm.
In his features and appearance, a beauty instead of ugliness, and he beats the beauty out of him, specifically stating, I wanted to destroy something beautiful.
That's so...
And then, let's add the other layer into this, because it's still dealing with this toxic masculinity thing. The character of Marla, who the narrator eventually starts to have a bit of a relationship with,
right?
But then has an issue because Tyler ends up having a sexual relationship with her. Now, what we understand later is, of course, it's still the narrator having the relationship with her the whole time.
Right.
But all of the sexual aspects, the manly aspects, the masculine aspects, Tyler was a part of. However, in the story, when Marla thinks that she may have a lump on her breast,
mm-hmm.
who does she call over to come check on the lump? The narrator.
Right.
And he acts in the capacity of a caring, nurturing individual. Moreover, the only interaction you see between Tyler and her is kind of the sexual interaction.
Yeah.
And even that, the beauty of that is it's not a straightforward sex scene where you actually see everything. It's a weird blended computer graphiced up little thing
that would represent
the fact that the narrator is doing it, but in an altered state where he has to let the Tyler character come forward.
Yeah, I remember that. I thought that was
masculine thing.
Very strange, but understandable.
Hindsight, right? It's
completely understandable.
And that's the thing, is anything that's masculine, he needs this other character to come forward. And this character is toxic. This character is problematic. This character takes over his life and makes him do things he doesn't realize he is doing. In his trips to various places as part of his job, he sets up fight clubs in different cities all over the U.S.
Right.
He has no idea because this masculine part of his life is taking over him, this toxicness. It's taking over him to the point that he doesn't remember anything that happens during it. And then you get to the fact that they decide to do a couple of different, that they have the fight club at first, and then they get into Project Mayhem where they're causing damage of property. They're causing they have a big thing that they're going to end up doing to try to set everything straight. Now, this is where the setting of the movie comes into play and the buildings that get blown up. The movie is set on the East Coast.
Okay.
In New Jersey.
Okay.
It's set in one of the cities in New Jersey where all of the major banks have their main office buildings. All of, like, the major banks in the United States, they have their main office buildings.
Hold on.
All of their...
Hold on. Wait one fucking second.
I'm waiting.
This takes place in Jersey. I think I know where this is going, but please, I want you to say it.
The buildings that are being blown up are where they house all of their computer records of all of their loans and all of their big business stuff. The point of it being to wipe, and all their credit card stuff too, to wipe the slate clean of debt for all of these people who have been, all these young men who have been put into debt for college, for all the things that they've been forced to buy to keep up with it. This debt is also what's taking away their masculinity. It's they're having to owe money and get themselves further and further in debt to live up to this standard of this new man that makes sure his wife has all these different things and he has all these different things and he's wearing, you know, pink shirts and the short shorts with sandals and socks. He's got to be able to afford all that crap, and he pays all this money for it, and he gets himself deeper and deeper in debt, has to buy the house that's you know, the specific house that's necessary, not one he can build and, you know, work on or something like that. No, it has to be the perfect house in the perfect neighborhood from the soulless job that he had to take because it's a new era of who he has to be as a man and a provider, right?
Right.
You blow up these banks, you take out all these banks, all their goal is all the debt's supposed to be gone, these office buildings. So the big buildings you see blow up at the end, these are the main offices of these banks. The idea being all the records will be destroyed, no loans owed money on, no credit cards owed money on, wipe the slate clean. That's the point.
What year did this come out?
1999.
Oh, that's funny.
Mm-hmm. That's the whole, that's where the property damage comes in. But here's what happens at the end. At the end, the narrator starts to break away from the Tyler character and what the Tyler character is trying to do. He doesn't want to be a part of it anymore, and he goes to try to stop all of this from happening because he realizes what this toxicity has brought him to.
Mm-hmm.
The violence, the destruction of property, the terrorism that's happening and about to happen. He realizes how horrible all these things are, and he's trying to put a stop to them. And the Tyler side of him is fighting back. In fact, the Tyler side of him has already set up all these members of this club and this project that they set together. He's already, the Tyler side of him has already told them, no, don't listen to me if I'm, you know, when I start talking about this, once the project starts, once we, you know, hit this point, don't listen to me anymore because I'm not going to be me anymore. I'm going to try to stop it, yada, yada, yada. And he fights through this to the end. And at the end, what does he do? Technically, it's at the beginning of the movie as well. He does it at the very beginning of the movie. And then you go back, you tell the whole story and come back to this moment. The main character, the narrator, eats a bullet. He takes a gun, puts it in his mouth. He's pointing at Tyler at first and realizing shooting him does nothing.
Right.
He's a construct. He's a figment of my imagination. So the narrator shoots himself in the mouth.
Right.
Ends up going out the back of his, the side of his neck. Side of his mouth, neck area.
Right.
Misses any major blood vessels. He lives through the shot. And Marla is there with him at that moment. And he walks up to her. You got a wonderful Pixie song playing. Buildings explode. And he says to her, "You met me at a very strange time in my life." And then reaches out and holds her hand. This is the only real outward side of just basic affection towards her. Other than checking her, and you don't see him, we kind of see him doing the check in the boob for whether it's got a lump or anything in it.
Yeah.
But he reaches out and holds her hand. The narrator does. Not the Tyler portion of it. Right. The narrator does. He shows her appropriate affection of like, it's the innocent and simple affection of just reaching out and holding her hand. Not making it about, I'm going to dominate you in a sexual manner with my masculinity. It's just reaching out and holding her hand and standing side by side with her, watching these buildings in front of him just blow up and crumble into dust. This is a journey of a man having this existential crisis about where his place is in life, this toxic masculinity wanting to come out, and him having to stop that toxic masculinity from coming out by extreme measure, shooting himself, because he realized how dangerous that mindset is, that toxic masculine mindset, how dangerous it is, how much damage it can cause, how much it can distort your mind and mess up your life. And he's finally found something to give his life meaning, somebody that he has affection for, somebody that he loves, somebody that he can treat with respect, and that actually respects him and loves him. Didn't really love Tyler because Tyler didn't exist.
Right.
But that's the thing is this is basically a tale of how destructive and terrible toxic masculinity is.
Interesting.
That mindset is. That was David Fincher's entire purpose and point in the making of the film. He wanted to try to draw in these people who love this as a, you know, oh, this is exactly what I'm feeling. I don't want to be emasculated anymore. I want to be a man. I want to be like Tyler Durden. I want to, you know, dress the way he dresses, do the things that he do. I want to express that violence in that way. I'm not the shoes I wear. I'm not the pants that I buy, you know, I'm none of these things.
Huh?
And yet the whole point was to say, yeah, well, that's all wrong. And it's so wrong that the narrator is willing to kill himself to get rid of it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I can kind of get, but I understand the point of it. I understand the point. So I feel like I've been kind of only seeing about half the movie thus far, up to a degree. I have heard of a few fan theories that are actually very interesting. One of them is that the narrator, when he shoots himself in the head, actually dies.
That's possible.
As the buildings go down. I'm still a little weird about the bank records kind of a thing. I understand you said it came out in like 99, right?
Yeah.
It's like long before a full solid internet, but this was bank records, so you know that they've got a backup. Yeah. It's somewhere else. I mean, that's not gonna entirely demolish that.
Actually, it probably would have demolished most of the major records.
Interesting.
That was the idea. The idea behind it was this is where all of these things were kept. So the idea was, and again, the Texas were the first ones to really start feeling, because of the push for you have to go to college and get a good career, mm-hmm. and then the increasing costs of college as those things built up.
Yeah.
They were the first ones to really feel the heavy pain of huge student debt, huge personal debt, and then not able to get the job that they were promised they were going to get by having all of this debt.
Dang.
Okay. To help alleviate this debt. So this is, and that's the thing, is Fincher was in a sense a part of that group.
Right.
And he understood that there was this prevalent mindset. There still is this prevalent mindset of men that feel like they're emasculated in some way. They don't get to have the proper experience of being a man. And when they get the opportunity to do that in whatever fringe group they get involved in to do that, Fincher saw the level of toxicity that would end up bringing. And that's what this is. Again, this is a satire on these. It's like I said, supposed to draw in those people that look at this and go, wow, this is neat, and then try to teach them, no, this is wrong. Look at all the trouble this mindset causes.
Interesting. So the question that I have is, if that's the case, why was it so grossly misinterpreted by everyone I knew that watched it, that loved the living piss out of it? Like, how do you miss? Because it's obvious I missed a lot of that information. Although, as you mention it, it makes sense from, you know, really digging deep into it and seeing that that's the case. But I don't understand how. They see the part of it that they get to glorify those that the toxicity of the storyline and of the way that the characters act.
They see the part of it that supports their worldview.
And that's where they stop. They see
the part of it that emboldens them.
That's where they stop.
Yes, that's
where they stop. So it's weird. It's like So what you're telling me is I entirely got the movie without entirely getting the movie.
Yeah, kind of.
That's
why I said.
A very strange take on it. Yeah.
That's why I said you were right and you were wrong.
Yeah,
because you saw that was everything that you were meant to.
Yes, but rather than understanding that's the parody that it was supposed to be, I took it as serious on its face, which is why I hated it.
Well, and let's add on to that.
Yeah,
I don't want to delve too much into your private life, but I know that over the last couple of years, especially since getting married and being with your wife, you've gone on a personal journey, learning a lot of things about yourself, a lot of things that you learned throughout your life. And I'm sure that the many times that you've watched this movie, you weren't necessarily as lightened about some of those elements in your own life as much as you are now.
Some of them, yes. Yes, for sure. There were always parts of the film that rubbed me the wrong way. Certain films that I liked or I didn't like because of XYZ. But it's more recently that I can actually vocalize an explanation as to why I did or did not like said thing. And that really makes a lot of difference in my ability to really interpret and reinterpret a lot of these films.
And I mean, I'm not even speaking about that as much as I'm speaking about some of the personal journeys that you've had learning that we all go through, especially as we can take this from the male perspective. That we're, you know, I'm 40. You're going to be 40 in a couple of years here.
Yeah.
You've had to grow and learn as a man in a new and modern world. You haven't had to deal with the child part of the situation, which is a whole different aspect to it. But you've had to deal with the growing as a man in this world, and you've seen where the toxic masculinity has become more of an issue, has become more easily identifiable, and the people that cling to it in a much stronger way than they used to, because they feel it's being taken away from them.
Right.
And so they feel they have to express it even more and more for what they feel is the lack of it in society. And in many ways, this movie was ahead of its time in dealing with that in a way that hadn't really been touched on up to that point. And it is touched on much later in other things. Part of the argument when the Joker came out was the elements and themes of the toxic masculinity and the incel connections involved with that.
Yes.
And both of these have encounters with people, both movies, the Fight Club and the Joker, have encounters with people that completely happen within the main character's head that don't actually exist.
Right.
But
right.
Some of the things I want to point out are the narrator in Fight Club stops the evil toxic masculinity by basically trying to kill himself. The evil toxicness, I wouldn't say masculinity so much, but the evil toxicness is the character of the Joker. He is that. And again, we also go to the to what the filmmakers were trying to do. David Fincher was specifically trying to make a satire to show how bad this kind of a mindset is.
Yes.
Todd Phillips was mad that he couldn't make the kind of comedies he makes anymore, or he used to make anymore, because of the PC culture and you can't make fun of certain things anymore. So instead, he was going to make a whole different kind of comic book movie that turned comic book movies on its head, which is basically a white guy arguing that his ability to do things the way he wanted to do in a masculine way, raunchy, disgusting jokes. He made the Hangover movies. The raunchy, disgusting jokes that he made all of his money off weren't being as accepted anymore. In a way, his masculinity was being stripped away, he felt. His ability to do the things his way was being stripped away. So he was going to make this movie to lash out at that. And this is actual things that he spoke of in an interview for his reasonings for making Joker and making Joker the way that it was. So in a sense, he is the very type of person that David Fincher was trying to warn against.
That's interesting. I'm going to have to take a look into those interviews, because what I gleaned from the Joker's film is a very similar, it's a very similar premise to Fight Club. The only difference is the main character. The main character has already lost by the time the film starts. He has nothing left of himself. And what it's about is the slow descent into madness that turns him into the villain, even though he already is gone. Like that's what feels like the point to me anyway. But I can understand where you're coming from with that. I definitely have to catch those interviews for sure, because that kind of puts it in a whole different kind of a light too, you know, after seeing everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can understand that, sir.
It's really funny because the Joker seems to put it out in a more simplistic fashion, where you don't have to think about the descent into madness of the character himself. And it does attempt to humanize a terrible person who wasn't initially a terrible person. But the purpose in it is that he essentially in that film, the Joker becomes a product of that environment. But that part is similar to Fight Club. But the difference here is that by the time the opening frames of the movie have started, he's already lost. There's no return for him. And it's just you're watching something that's already happened continue to happen. That's what I dealt from it. And it, that's, I mean, otherwise the Joker doesn't become the Joker. He becomes, what does he become? Nothing? A hero? Well, neutral? What does he become? You know?
Well, I mean, there are some that want to look to him as being a hero by the end of that movie.
Those people are incorrect. And I will say that vehemently right now.
They are just as incorrect as the people who look at Fight Club as their reason to hold on to toxic masculinity and want to start their own Fight Club, and thinking that Tyler Durden is their hero.
That's the craziest part, was that people were fucking doing that at one point. They were actually doing shit like that. They probably still do. I don't know. I don't take part in that kind of crap. But
there are people that still do. People that still identify with him and see him as their example for things. And that's the thing is, the difference is, and why I use that as a comparison is, Fincher's entire purpose was to point out how stupid people were for identifying with Tyler Durden,
and then a bunch of people identify with Tyler Durden on accident.
No, they still did. The thing is, he knew that they still would, but for the rest of us, the rest of us that understand the movie,
right?
That gives us the knowledge to know that specific friend is kind of an asshole douchebag, and we don't want to be around him too much.
Agreed with that, man. Whereas,
the reason for my not wanting to see the Joker and not necessarily wanting to give it the credit that it was given by so many people, mm-hmm. I don't think that Todd Phillips gives us the same kind of ability to look at that character and not want to be that character. I think he glorifies that character more so with the way that the film was handled. He doesn't use him as an object lesson of what not to be. He makes people, he whether he specifically wants people to want to follow him or he just allows people to make the choice to follow him, he doesn't give you any indication at any point of not to be like him. And that's where my personal feelings about how Fight Club, I believe, to be an important movie for people to watch and to analyze and understand. And again, I will probably never see the Joker because I don't feel the same level of messages there. And in fact, even Todd Phillips and Joaquin Phoenix went on record to say that they don't believe it's the job of, well, this is more Joaquin Phoenix than Todd Phillips. He specifically said, when asked about the character in the movie and the possible reaction from people, he said he doesn't believe it's the job of filmmakers to try to teach morals to anybody. They just make art. And I disagree. I think that that art is an important way to try to teach morals to people and get people to understand.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that put out fantastic material that would heavily disagree with that.
And I would say that, to me, that's a cop out from somebody who I don't consider that good of an actor personally. not wanting to take responsibility for what could be a interesting situation. I think I personally see that as a cop out, but that's just me. I feel if you've done the work, you should have understanding and pride in the thing that you've done and the message that you've tried to convey. And, you know, whatever. But anyway, so hopefully, from the sound of it, I think I've made you want to take another look at Fight Club, maybe give it a little bit more understanding for the fact that it has maybe more depth than you was. And I think that was probably the biggest issue. I don't think you quite recognize the depth that the movie had. And you just kind of saw the surface thing, which was the intent to get people in the doors was to see the surface of it.
Right.
And then to hit you with the depth later. And most people just focus on the twist and how the twist is set up. But even that is a way to try to get that subtext into you, that depth of meaning into you, mm-hmm. in a way that was not trying to be so heavy-handed and bash it down your throat. It was for it to organically come as you paid attention to the movie. Interesting note, I saw that movie in the theater.
Oh, really?
With one other person. Me and a girl I went to college with. Mm-hmm. We had invited one of our – she was actually in my first band with me. I brought her in to be a part of the band with two of my buddies, uh-huh. who are great instrumentalists. The two of them could play like 10 different instruments each. I mean, I saw one of them we went into a music store one time. He just grabbed a cello and sat down and started playing a cello. And I was like, dude, you're awesome. I mean, bow and everything, right?
Nice.
Dude, you're awesome. I didn't know you know how to play the cello. He's like, I've never played a cello before. This is fun. I'm like, I hate you, dude. I really, really hate you. But she was in the theater program with me. Great voice. So I brought her in to be a part of the band to sing. And we were inviting one of the brothers to come to see the movie with us. He never showed up to see the movie with us. So her and I were just like, all right, fine, let's go see this movie. Totally platonic relationship, by the way. I want to make that clear.
Okay.
But we went and saw this movie, and we went to Lyons afterwards, back when there was a Lyons restaurant, back when those existed.
Yeah.
And I think we got like, we didn't have a whole lot of money, neither one of us. So I think we both got like, we each got like a salad, because they would bring out the little loaf of bread with the salad and just like water. And her and I sat for 2 hours talking about all the different things that were in this film. And I think that was actually very helpful to me, because I was able to talk with some with at the time. Now, I've always had a you know, because you knew her, but I think we've discussed on here before. My mother was a very hardcore feminist, so yes. I got a lot of different perspective of life as I was growing up.
Right.
But to be able to sit and have that conversation about this movie and the things that were in this movie. Before, toxic masculinity was a catchphrase that people used, and that I have used a whole lot in this podcast. But before that was something that was said, there was still some of the idea behind it. And to be able to sit and talk with a female friend, again, the reason I mentioned it was platonic. There wasn't a romantic involvement between the two of us. Mm-hmm. So the discussion we had wasn't colored in any way by that. I wasn't trying to impress her as a romantic partner. She wasn't trying to impress me. These were just two friends being able to talk about and theater people. So we know acting. We knew the stuff that goes into it. Just talk about the various things that we saw within this movie and have the discussion where all this stuff was very visible to me from the beginning, but that's because I had that moment, that 2 hours of sitting and talking and going over this film, and it was such a wonderful, amazing experience to sit and talk about the movie and go through all the things and see all of the hidden subtext that he was trying to get out with this. And the idea that, yeah, we thought we were just going in to see, you know, she was going there to see Brad Pitt, and I was going there to see, you know, what the heck this movie was that everybody was talking about.
Right.
And became a whole different thing.
Interesting.
And it was kind of neat to be able to have seen it that way, have the discussion with it, and then have the understanding that he was working on multiple levels, as David Fincher often does with his movies. He was working on multiple levels to try to make you understand what was going on and what his purpose was. And he had a defined purpose. This is satire. This is showing how awful this kind of thought frame can be. These people these 30-something white men who feel like they're disenfranchised by the world. This is where their minds can lead them from this disenfranchisement. And their ultimate goal in the end is to reconcile their place in the world and understand that it's okay to be the narrator. It's okay to be that guy. Even though, and it's funny, we mentioned the fact that he's the narrator. His life is so unimportant, he doesn't even get a name. And yet that's okay to be that guy.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, think about that. He doesn't even have a name. And that's part of what many of these disenfranchised people feel. And again, they're prevalent in our world today so much. These 30-something, even younger, 20 to 30-something white males who feel like they're disenfranchised by this world. You wrote a song that had something, same kind of an idea, Quarter Life Crisis.
Yeah.
This feeling of disconnect from all of this. And they feel like they're nobody. They're, you know, nobody cares about them. They're just a number amongst other things.
Yeah.
That's what this movie deals with. And you have to figure out how to reconcile those issues, because if you don't, that's the carnage you can cause. That's the damage you can cause. It can scar you for life, and it can destroy the world around you. So get it under control. That's the point of Fight Club.
Interesting.
Much more than you would think. Well, it's not just about making soap.
I feel weird about it, knowing that I was seeing everything. It's almost like it sounds to me more so that it's not the issue that I don't necessarily take the issue so much with the film at this point as much as I take it with the audience that has become a cult around it.
Yes, and I agree with you on that.
If that's the point, if that's what it is, if that's how quote unquote awesome
that was the intention.
This is supposed to be, cool. I mean, I can get behind that. I can understand that. Now, I can't remember any other films that I've seen by Fincher, so I don't have really much of a point of reference for him.
Seven.
Never saw it. So
you never saw Seven?
Never saw Seven. Never
Dear
seen it.
God.
Nope. I know the plot twist, and okay, like that's cool, but I've never wanted to sit.
Actually, what's funny about the plot twist in that, what I do want to say is funny about the plot twist, because it is. It's a really funny thing now. That plot twist and the plot twist in The Usual Suspects, for a while, those were great plot twists because of the actor involved in the plot twists. Because at the time, nobody knew who Kevin Spacey was as an actor.
Right.
So the fact that he was in both those plot twists was actually really good. Because like Usual Suspects, Kevin Spacey has a part in it, and you're thinking, he's not anybody important. After those movies came out, specifically after American Beauty came out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Anything that Kevin Spacey was in, anything at all that Kevin Spacey was in, seriously, you couldn't have that reveal, because like you watch The Usual Suspects and Kevin Spacey's in, it's like, he's got to be playing a big role. It's freaking Kevin Spacey. Now, the right. upside of the way the world works now, hopefully in 10 years, Kevin Spacey will be forgotten enough because of the awful and horrible things he did outside of his career. He may have been forgotten enough in the public zeitgeist that people can actually go back and watch the usual suspects and Seven and not have the plot twists messed up for them, because they'll be like, who the heck is that guy? We haven't seen anything from him. That's my hope. Seven, Zodiac, Gone Girl, The Social Network.
Oh, that's all Fincher?
Being John Malkovich. Nope, he's an
I did see Being John Malkovich. Being John Malkovich was an acid trip of awesomeness. I did like Being John Malkovich.
He didn't direct that, though.
Did he write it?
He was in it.
He was in it? Oh.
Yeah, he had a part in it.
Oh, okay. Probably because he just appreciated the material.
Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Oh, okay. Basically, like, any major dramatic picture with Brad Pitt in it at this point has been Fincher?
Oh, interesting. He directed the video for A Perfect Circle, the Judith video.
Whoa, he did. That's
cool. The Game with Michael Douglas.
Oh. Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Let's see. Curious Case of Benjamin Button. He's done a lot of music. Social Network, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, okay.
He directed a couple episodes of House of Cards. Not a big deal. Gone Girl, and then a couple episodes of the TV series Mindhunter.
Cool.
So he's a decent director that has a lot of subtext, a lot of different meaning to his stuff. And that's the thing is he had that intention and that purpose to add more subtext, to add more to a movie than just what you see on the upper layers.
Cool, man. All right. Well, I'm going to have to take a look at more of his material, especially with that capability. It's one of those things that you got to watch multiple times to really get what's going on.
I think everybody should take a look at more of his material. Seven and The Game is an amazing movie. That is a really, really good movie. Oh. Michael Douglas, near his prime. Sean Penn. I mean, do you remember that film, or have you never seen The Game?
It's been a very, very long time since I've seen The Game, but I remember that one.
That's a really good movie.
Yeah.
That's one that'll mess at your head as well. But not funny enough, in a really, really good way. It's another one of those that has kind of a reveal and a twist to it.
Cool.
We call M. Night Shyamalan the twist guy. I don't know. Fincher's got a little bit of twistiness going on in him.
He does, but he doesn't make the twists like his marketability. He doesn't make it the purpose of the film, which is why Shyamalan is so predictable. Like, yeah, you're like, oh, okay. It's a Shyamalan film. Okay. So basically, reality is not what reality is, and it's going to be some dumb explanation for it. Like, that's what everybody thinks at this point.
Exactly. So anybody listening in, go watch some of David Fincher's films.
Yeah.
Great filmmaker. Watch you some Fight Club again. Watch it again with what I've said and see if you notice these things a little bit more. See if you can see what he was really trying to convey with this.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, Mike.
Yes.
We're at the end of our show, so you get to do your bit. Where can people be listening to us?
Well, you should be listening to us at thezenialchronicles.com right now if you're seeing this on our site, or you could have typed zenchron.com, spelled X-E-N-C-H-R-O-N, to listen to the podcast from the main site, but you can also listen to us on other major platforms, mainly, let's see, Spotify and Google and, not iTunes, Apple and the what?
Tune in.
Yes, tune in as well. Also, catch us on YouTube and on Facebook, by the way. Our podcasts come out on Facebook and on YouTube. And if you're on YouTube, please click that subscribe button and click the like button on the video if you dig what we're talking about. And click the bell icon, too, so that the next time we have a podcast on YouTube, you'll know about it.
And while you're on YouTube, checking out our YouTube page, clicking all of those various things to follow us, going through all of our old stuff, in case you haven't listened to it all yet, hop on over and check out Chronisode Games, right? I said that right?
Chronisode Games, yes.
Chronisode Games,
yes.
Which is a project that Mike is doing with his wife, where they are playing through video games
yes.
in the chronological order of the video game universe, not in the order of when the games are were put out.
Yep, yep.
And they play the game. Right now, Mike is playing a couple of different ones.
Yep.
And they talk about the game, some history stuff, discussion about how terrible a video game player Mike is.
Yep.
It's a lot of fun.
And oh my god! Episode is the episode that came out today. Today's Monday. This episode will come out on Thursday. So, if you look at Monday's episode of Legend of Zelda, it is very entertainingly dumb.
Yeah, read the title. I read the title and I'm like, "Yep, he messed up. He messed up a bunch."
The whole video, man. It was great.
And then when you're done watching all of that and laughing at Mike's kind of silliness and that, go check out something a little more serious by Mike. Also on YouTube is Ruling Note Music.
Yes.
This is a page that Mike does instruction on musical recording technique, history of music stuff. It's just if you're into music at all, especially if you are a musician of any type, go check that out. See what you think of it. And with both of those, like them, follow them, click the bells on those. Because guess what, people? If you're listening to this, you must either like listening to me or listening to Mike. If you like listening to me, go see a psychiatrist. If you like listening to Mike, check out those other things. Anyway, thank you all for listening to us, and hopefully we'll be back next week with something even more fun and interesting for you.
Yeah, y'all have a good one.
Thank you for tuning in, friends. The journey continues next week.